Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloen. As we produced this program, fires were still raging in Southern California, and since we're based in an area all too familiar with massive fires here in Northern California, we decided it was time to take an in-depth look with our scientific lens on what we can learn from fire in order to try and make our wildlands, communities, and homes safer from catastrophic burning. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Ralph Blomers, director of Fire Safe Communities based in Oregon. Blomers has also been a producer for the PBS program Elemental that examined the role of fire on the Western landscape. He's an expert on helping communities understand and better prepare for a warmer, drier climate that's increasing wildfire risk throughout the world. But first, our guest is one of the world's foremost experts on the history of fire. Stephen J. Pine is a professor emeritus at Arizona State University, and he's written dozens of books on the history of wildfires and how fire has shaped both the landscape throughout time and our role in both using it as a tool and attempting to tame it to protect homes and property. He joins us now from his home in Arizona. Stephen Pine, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I'd like you to give us some perspective on fire in terms of the big picture. But before we get to that, I'd like to know how you came to be interested in fire. Because I saw that it happened when you were working at the Grand Canyon back in the day. Tell us that story real quickly.
Yeah, I got interested in fire completely accidentally, complete serendipity, and it changed my life. I was 18 a few days after graduating from high school, and I got a job as a laborer at Grand Canyon, and I was on the South Rim signing my papers, and a guy from the North Rim fire crew called in and said he wouldn't be able to make it, and they were anxious to fill that slot. There I was. They asked me, do you want to work on a fire crew in the North Rim? I'd never been on a fire crew, never been on the North Rim. I was 18, so I said, sure. And I did that for 15 seasons, 12 as crew boss.
And then how did that lead to your academic interest in fire? Because you have poured yourself into that.
Well, I never studied fire in school. It was never taught anywhere, certainly not where I went to school, but I don't think it was taught anywhere back in those days. It's something you learned on the job. So I went through a basic academic routine. I became interested in history, wrote my dissertation, biography of an American geologist and explorer, G.K. Gilbert. And then realized this was 1976. I really had no academic positions available. I was working on the South Rim. They had a winter seasonal position and just doing odd jobs in the South Rim waiting for fire season to return, and decided, you know, I really liked fire. It was commanding more and more of my interest. And why didn't I take the training I'd been given and apply that to fire? And no one was really doing that. There are a number of people doing fire science of various kinds, but really looking at sort of the large fire-human relationship as cultural history. I say that in the older sense of that term. What are the institutions, the policies? All the kinds of stuff that would come together. So that led to Fire in America, my first book. And then thereafter, I decided I could learn more doing comparative histories than continuing to drill down into the American story. So I've had a chance to do Australia and Canada, Europe, including Russia, and just published a book last April on a fire history in Mexico.
And interesting, in the Mexico book, you bring the story of Chicxulub and the impact from the Cretaceous, the asteroid impact, into that story. So I'd kind of like to do that kind of thing right now. Is take a planetary history look at fire, because fire has not always been on the landscape on planet Earth. When did fire first become part of the ecological story of Earth?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the underpinning for this story is that fire is a creation of the living world. And Earth is a uniquely fire planet. It's the only planet we know that has it. And this is because it has life in the way we understand it. So the Earth got an atmosphere filled with oxygen. Well, that's part of it. That was mostly from the oceans. And then when life began to establish itself in the continents over 420 million years ago, that provided the fuel. And there was always an ignition source, lightning, if nothing else. So we have fossil charcoal dating back over 420 million years. So basically, as long as we've had living landscapes, that is on terrestrial sites, we've had fire. Not every place had it every year. It was patchy, some places more, some less, some certain times, some other times. But fire has co-evolved with the whole Earth's biota. There are times when fire is, the planet is warmed or it's more favorable to fire in some ways. So we get more evidence of it. Other times it has less, but it's always been around. And then the big event is when one creature, the genus, the hominins, acquires the ability to start fire, more or less at will, and begins changing itself. And then when it's finally reduced to one single species, us, we begin changing the planet.
Yeah, it's interesting. You even have like a terminology for it of first fire, second fire, and third fire. And I was wondering, could you kind of lead us through what those terms mean to you?
Sure. This was my effort to sort of distill a very complicated and messy story into a fairly simple schematic. First fire is simply the fire that belongs on Earth, with or without people. Humans could disappear tomorrow and fire would continue. It would continue as long as the Earth is oxygenated, as long as it has hydrocarbons in exposed sites, as long as lightning continues. But people, we eventually developed a relationship to fire, a very interesting one. Here's how I would simplify that story, that we got big heads and small guts because we learned to cook food. I mean, fire is in our genome. That's how deeply related we are. But we went to the top of the food chain when we learned to cook landscapes. And now we've become a geologic force because we're cooking the planet. So that is the story, if you will, of mostly of second fire. And what I mean by that is that there's an old concept of second nature that you can see Cicero wrote a famous essay on in ancient times. And the idea is that people by hand and mind took the stuff of the natural world and remade a new world out of it, a second nature, refashioned it. And that is, in a sense, is what we did with fire. We were able to domesticate it, tame it, capture it in various forms, and use it primarily to make and then inhabit this second nature world that humans live in. So that's second fire. And the third fire is the burning of fossil fuels. And this changes the dynamics of fire on the planet. It changes the relationship of people to fire. Previously, the quest for fire had always been about finding new stuff to burn and ways to burn it. But when you start taking stuff out of the geologic past and then processing it and then releasing its effluent into the geologic future, you are outside the old ecological give and take that 420 million years of coevolution had created. So you can burn day and night, winter, summer, wet or dry, it doesn't matter. Your fire impact is not by putting flame onto landscapes or food. It can come indirectly by creating machines that help you reorganize your landscapes and hence reorganizing the fuels. By substituting this third fire, a very different, qualitatively different kind of fire, substituting that for second fire. And so you get this kind of three-body problem of first, second, and third fires all sort of hovering over the same pixel and competing and in some ways colluding. So for the most part, we've used, the developed world has used third fire to replace second fire. So it's gone out of most of our houses. We don't really use working fires inside anymore to heat, cook, illuminate. And it's gone out of most of our cities. That's sort of what it means to be in a developed country. But then we've also taken it out of our agriculture. The Green Revolution is really based not just on clever genetics, but the petrochemicals that add to make these selective cultivars more productive and to power the machines that allow you to distribute that and power the pumps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we've tried to carry it into our wildlands, public lands, nature preserves, and so forth. And many places that are naturally fire-prone, this has been a disaster. So we're dealing with that. The other problem with third fire, of course, is that by changing the atmosphere, filling it with greenhouse gases, you're globally warming the planet. So that affects every place, whether a particular country or people has made that transition to third fire or not, they are feeling the consequences. And now we're seeing sort of the Sorcerer's Apprentice story of having unleashed all this power. We find ourselves unable to control it. We can disrupt things, but we haven't yet been able to achieve serious management of them. So that, in a nutshell, is the three sort of qualitatively different realms of fire on the planet. And that's the prism by which I continue to refract most of my understanding of fire on the landscape.
And, of course, there's the term we see often now, the Anthropocene, where humans have, you know, kind of started to globally affect the planet. And you use an interesting term instead of that, the Pyrocene. Tell us why you believe the Pyrocene is a better term to use.
Well, I like Anthropocene, and I like a long Anthropocene. I begin it at the end of the last ice age. I would simply rename the Holocene, the Anthropocene. But then I would take it a step further because I'm trying to see the world through a pyric prism and call it a Pyrocene because I think that fire has provided the power. Fire directly or indirectly has provided most of humanity's firepower and allowed us to make these kinds of changes. So my sense that what motivated me to think of a Pyrocene in particular, I was struck by the commentaries that are so pervasive that our future is not only dire, but strange. So much so that we have no narrative by which to connect that future to our past. And we have no analog by which to guide us in our understanding of that future. And coming at the story from a fire perspective, I think we have both. We have a great narrative. It's the unbroken saga of humanity and fire. We made a kind of mutual assistance pact long, long ago. We've had fire as a companion all of our existence as a species. And that is a continual story. And I can see the fossil fuel story as a part of that fire story. I can see all of the changes that are leading to climate change and the knock-on effects of that. I can see that as part of this unbroken fire story. At the same time, I think in trying to characterize the consequences of all this, a very apt analog suggests itself, at least to me, and that is that we are creating the fire equivalent of an ice age, that we have broken the series of ice ages that characterized the Pleistocene, and by our use of fire, we are replacing it. So imagine all the features of an ice age, all the classic sort of larger cluster of images and phenomenon, and replace it with fire-informed ones. So instead of great ice sheets and iced over oceans, well, we're driving the ice off everywhere. We're replacing it with more fire-prone landscapes. Large biogeographic shifts underway, climate change underway, changes in sea level, mass extinctions. Maybe instead of proglacial lakes, great pluvial phenomena, we have heat domes and smoke palls. All these sort of great features of the classic ice ages, I can find fire analogs for it. So that is my sense of what's going on. For me, climate change is simply one of the consequences. And frankly, from my perspective, climate history is now becoming a sub-narrative of fire history.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with fire historian Stephen Pine from Arizona State University. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our recent interview with Stephen Pine. Stephen is a professor emeritus at Arizona State University and one of the world's foremost experts on the history of fire on the landscape.
Europeans had a very deep interaction with fire, and it was part of their traditional ecological knowledge. But it was always embedded in agriculture. Europe was a built environment. Not just out of stone and brick, but out of biological materials, remade, the second nature image. And fire was always a part of that. So it is not the case that European settlers came over and immediately eliminated traditional burning or anthropogenic burning. In some cases, the disappearance by disease or war or relocation eliminated the indigenous practices, but often there were hybrids or even borrowings. And there are accounts, one of my favorites is from the Boundary Survey for what became the Plumas National Forest. This was in 1904, and the surveying crew is commenting, the head of party is commenting, says, well, you know, everybody's burning here. And the practice had been common with the American Indian preceded. The white man has simply picked up the torch and added his own. So everybody's burning, prospectors, cattlemen, timbermen, everybody with an interest. And nobody cares about it. It all seems natural. And so that's not a story of actually having this sharp break. In some places it happens. But more often there are all kinds of hybrids. Yeah, there's a map of the country from 1880. It was produced by the census, incredibly enough. And you see an awful lot of fire, which would not have been true if Europeans simply disdained and immediately sought to eradicate it. If they had, they couldn't have lived. What makes the change is partly the transition to third fire, where you acquire the ability through machines to begin suppressing, and you also begin changing how you live on the landscape. And a part of that change is a wave of very large megafires in the 19th and early 20th century, most of it catalyzed by railroads and logging and land clearing. And that provided a backdrop for the need to eliminate these kinds of fires. So what happens is that foresters are given that charge. Foresters, bless them, were probably the world's worst guild to hand over fire management decisions on. Forestry was created in temperate Europe, essentially in Germany, northern France. There is no natural basis for fire there. It's one of the anomalous places on the planet. And they saw fire simply as a problem of bad behavior. Or as our first professional forester in the U.S., Bernard Furneaux, a Prussian emigre, head of the Bureau of Forestry before it became the Forest Service, put it all, he says, looked at the American fire scene, it's all the result of bad habits and loose morals. You couldn't understand it. What you want to do is convert that wild land to agriculture. On the European model, you want plantations, you don't want fire, et cetera, et cetera. So foresters were hopeless on this. Their whole training and assumptions were for eliminating fire as much as possible. So there are a bunch of things come together. And at that point in the 20th century, we begin seeing this conversion where traditional burning, not only indigenous burning, but traditional burning by settlers and others is eliminated or becomes the goal of eliminating that kind of fire becomes prominent. And people are leaving the land, they're moving into cities, they're going into another place where fire is not a part of their lives, et cetera. So that all comes together and converge to create some of our present scenes.
When you compare the big burns of the late 19th century, mm-hmm. those kinds of fires, which were truly huge and sometimes tragic for, you know, human life, to what we're observing now in the West, you know, places like Paradise, California, what we just saw in Los Angeles, what are some big takeaways that you draw observing what you see now?
Well, bunches of things are possible. One is that there are many ways to get very large fires and damaging fires. It is not just the result of climate change. These large fires were occurring at the end of the Little Ice Age, a time that was really unusually cool. What powered them was enormous amounts of logging slash and land clearing debris that was left, most of which was then burned either deliberately or accidentally. A lot of the fires were set by trains, locomotives, and that this only required short periods of favorable fire weather, usually in spring and fall, to blow up. So there are different ways to get at it, and fuel can be enough on its own. What we're seeing now is a combination of different kinds of fuels plus climate change. So warming is taking the place of some of the other stuff that we had before. So that's one. Another is the positioning of these communities in these really high hazard environments. So most of the communities that were taken out, and there are records of hundreds of people being killed in these episodes, were in the midst of all this changed land. And their houses, communities were made out of the same wood that was providing fuel for the fire. So the fires burned exactly the same way. So our cities, even our major cities, burned as routinely as the surrounding countryside because they were made of the same materials. They responded to the same weather, same drought, same winds. And we broke that. San Francisco may have, in 1906, may have been the last of the large urban conflagrations until the end of the century when they come back across the bay in Oakland. But we learned how to stop that. And so we really have a much sharper division of urban fire and rural countryside fires, landscape fires outside it. And it's shocking for me to see that we had solved the problem, and now that problem is coming back. I mean, it's like having polio or smallpox come back, in a sense. What happened? How did this occur? Why are we having these?
What are the principal reasons why we're seeing this resurgence?
Well, partly is how we're building our communities, where we're building them, materials we're using. But I also think a sense that for several generations, urban conflagrations didn't exist. So why do you need to vaccinate if the disease has gone away or it's trivial? Why be inconvenienced? Why go through all of this regulation and onerous requirements and so forth? Because that's what it took to remove these fires and to make and create a market for fire insurance. I mean, fire insurance couldn't work in this sort of laissez-faire urban fire environment that went on before. And that's sort of it, you know, building codes, zoning codes, fire codes, roads, and infrastructure for fire protection.
Density of housing?
Well, it can be the density of housing, but, you know, you can build houses that don't carry fires between them in the same way that you can build structures that have firewalls and fire doors and things to either eliminate the passage of fire or slow it down enough that you can respond. But if you simply build structures close enough to ignite one another, but not so close that they could have a shared wall or stone concrete barrier between them, then you're going to have problems. And here's another paradox for you. And that, you know, the narrative is that the problem here is that we have people moving into fire-prone landscapes, and that is a problem. But Europe, Mediterranean Europe, which has had horrific fires in recent decades, identifies the problem as people moving out of fire-prone areas. because fire in a naturally fire-prone area there had been kept under wraps, contained by human use of the landscape, close cultivation, fields, pastures, conversion of conifer woodlands to orchards, and so forth. And when people fled the countryside to go to the cities, as they, particularly when they joined the EU and entered a sort of larger, even global market, that countryside was no longer tended. It went feral and now is powering these large fires, and some of which are converted to industrial forest plantations of eucalypts or Mediterranean pine, both of which are highly flammable. So the issue is not simply that you're living in a fire-prone area. The issue is how. And so that, I think, helps to change the discussion. It's not that you're going to shut it off, this continued conversion of rural land to urban, but it does say that if you want to live in this case without being burned out, you need to take adequate steps. And that's going to start with hardening your structures, designing the way in which fire may or may not transfer between structures. It's a communal effort. You know, if you do stuff for your place, but your neighbors don't, your house can still burn because theirs burned. So all these kinds of things come together.
Well, Stephen Pine, it was really great to talk to you about this topic that you're so passionate about. You definitely have a fire burning within you about fire. And it's really, really been fascinating to talk to you about the story of fire and planet Earth.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks to our guest, Stephen J. Pine, fire historian and professor emeritus at Arizona State University. Our next guest is also an expert on fire, especially on the practical aspects of how we can better use and adapt fire on the Western landscape in order to have safer homes and neighborhoods. Ralph Blomers is based in Portland, Oregon, director of Fire Safe Communities for the nonprofit Green Oregon Organization, and he's also a film producer who worked on the PBS program Elemental: Reimagine Wildfire, produced in 2023, and it chronicled the destruction of the town of Paradise by the campfire in 2018. It shows ways that we can try and harden our communities in the wake of catastrophic fires, which are unfortunately a big part of life in the Western U.S. He joins us now from his home in Portland. Ralph Blomers, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me on.
Ralph, I'd like you to just kind of, you've got an extensive background as in science and reporting and producing documentaries for PBS. Just give us a little short rundown on what you do and how you came to do it.
I have always been fascinated with fire from when I was a little kid and unsupervised with matches and gasoline on a farm that I grew up on. And luckily I had no escapes with my foolishness, but fast forward to finding myself later in life in Oregon. And I met a prescribed fire practitioner whose job was to burn the understory of forests and preserve the big trees. And, you know, I was initially thinking there would be nothing for me to see in a burned forest because they're so sort of maligned and misunderstood, but I was blown away by the beauty in burned landscapes and kind of started to see them as like a young person that was sprouting out in all directions and full of potential and life and birds and wildlife. And that was kind of my beginning journey, just sort of in the burned forest and with fire professionals and scientists. And, you know, a lot of the things that I know and talk about, I'm standing on the shoulders of the people that I've met over the years. And fast forward to 2017, and we had a big old wildfire in the gorge during an east wind event, which is similar to like any other of these downslope wind events that we know colloquially as, you know, Santa Ana's or Wasatch in Utah or Chinooks in Colorado. But it was a big one, 30 mile an hour plus winds, the ash rained down on the city of Portland. And I was brought in after to do storytelling for the community with scientists and organize a bunch of forums, because of my relationships with conservation groups, local groups, and philanthropy. I was funded to work with National Geographic filmmaker Trip Jennings to do storytelling about a fire that was just in a natural landscape, a beloved natural landscape that is like it's like a loved one for people around here and from far away, the Columbia River Gorge. So I set up time-lapse and wildlife cameras. But about a year into it, the campfire happened, which of course you all are very familiar with. And I had a friend who lost her school and lost her home, and we knew other people. And, you know, Tripp and I and Sarah looked at each other and were like, we need to do some storytelling around this. But ultimately, the thing that I'm deep on is trying to be an advocate for preventing these humanitarian disasters and how we, you know, interrupt. And I think that the reason I'm partly in it is because I think it is solvable. And I think it's solvable based on what I've learned from Jack Cohen, and I stand on his shoulders, you know, every day. But I think that, you know, I'm just committed to this concept of, yeah, we need the fire services. Yeah, government plays a role, but how do we all step up and do the things that we know the research shows will reduce the burden, reduce the chances of community loss, and, you know, in other words, be a force multiplier on the landscape. So that's my thing. That's who I am.
Well, let's talk about solutions, because, you know, that's what this is all about. And I'd like to start, you know, on kind of on the bigger scale and work our way down. As you mentioned, these kinds of fires do not occur without a lot of wind, dry wind, desiccating situation, and strong, usually northerly winds in California, north or easterly winds. And there's usually, almost always, a human cause to these. So what are some of the things we can do regionally to make sure this doesn't just keep happening?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate your mention of the dominant forces in community loss. You know, we know that wind events with fire in them are dangerous, right? We know that. But then they study it and they tell us things like 88% of home loss occurs in fast fires. In other words, these wind-driven fires. And that's what Jack calls the target conditions. And what Jack and Stephen Pine and others that are the forefront of saying what we need to do to prepare, they're saying we need to define the problem to meet the target conditions. And so in other words, you have to say the problem is not the fact that there's fire on the landscape, because it's a natural reality of the landscape and humans are part of the landscape and we've been lighting fires since the retreat of the ice sheets in the Pleistocene. So if you accept that fire is inevitable, even though, of course, it's beyond irritating, annoying, and upsetting that there's stupid human-caused fires or power line-ignited fires at the absolute wrong time, and we should be able to bend that one down and stop those. But if you just accept anyway that there's always will be fire on a fire-adapted landscape, what you need to do is define the problem as the vulnerability of the homes and communities. And Jack has been in all the fires after they burned, studied how the buildings ignited and burned, and he's crash tested in labs. He's done experiments in the Boreal and ignited crown fires near, you know, structure sections, and determined that it's basically 90% of homes ignite from burning embers, entering the crawl, entering the attic, igniting bark mulch below a fence. The fence ignites, transfers to the structure, you know, and you mentioned Paradise. I mean, we had so much footage, of course, heartbreaking footage of people with hoses not long enough to reach their neighbor's home and put out their neighbor's fence when they stayed and defended. So in other words, like in relationships, right? You know, big gestures matter, but really it's all the small things that matter. And in protecting homes, it's all the small things that matter. And it's mostly in the 0 to 5 feet. I call it the moat around the house, and then the pond of the community. And so in this situation, you see in Palisades and Eaton, you get a structure that's ignited because the lid on the garbage can flips over or the recycling bin flips over and embers land in that, ignite the paper, ignite the bin, and then ignite the tire on the adjacent car, and then the car ignites, and then the house ignites, or it ignites the shrub next to the house. So Jack just looked at all these different ways that heat transfers to an ember landing on a couch cushion, and then that couch cushion is synthetic, so it burns really hot and ignites the structure. And he just said, let's eliminate those things, and it's primarily like in that immediate zone around the structure. And if you get collectively the community to do it, which some communities are doing, then you become, you know, much more insurable. You reduce your chances for these kinds of events. And I think that to some degree, some insurance companies are starting to align with that. And some communities like Marin, Truckee, other ones in Colorado are scaling it.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with wildfire expert Ralph Blomers as we talk about ways to make our communities safer in a world where catastrophic fires are happening with greater frequency. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to my conversation with Ralph Blomers, director of Fire Safe Communities based in Portland, Oregon. Ralph has also worked on the film Elemental, reimagining wildfire that was produced for PBS in the wake of the campfire that destroyed most of Paradise, California in 2018. Well, let's talk about an individual home and yard.
Yeah.
If you're looking at a house and you're maybe being consulted by some friends, so what can we do here, Ralph? What are the first things that you look at?
Well, I've gotten to know there's a lot of fire tech out there, and some of it's fried air and snake oil, but there's some really good fire tech out there. And one of them is this software that helps firefighters and fire services go and assess homes. And I asked them, it's like, how many assessments have you done? And they said over 100,000. I said, could you output for me what are the top five things that consistently over all your 100,000 plus assessments come up? And he said, well, it's, to some degree, it depends on the construction methods in the community, but here they are. Bark, 0 to 5, non-combustible. So that's bark mulch replaced with rock. Remove shrubs.
Okay, let's stop there. Remove shrubs where?
0 to 5 feet from the house.
Okay. So anytime somebody's got shrubbery, and I've got it at our house, right up against the house, that's not a good thing.
Definitely not a good thing. We did on our house, my wife was like, you made this film, Ralph, we should do the things. I'm like, okay. And I was like, I love my red osier dogwood. Yeah. So it's partly the plant that you choose. So we cut back the red osiers and then they sprouted up a little bit further out. But like, we have river rock, we have some pavers. It doesn't need to be an ugly prison yard. You can, there's design competitions and there's cool stuff you can do. The other one is next, the gutters, bone clean or no gutters. I mean, in rural areas and heavy snow load areas, a lot of people don't have gutters, but if you can remove them, cool. But if you can't, you got to keep them. I'm not a real big fan of gutter guards because, if anybody, maintains a house, nature finds a way to make work for you. Yeah. So, just keep them bone clean, because if the fines in a gutter ignite, they ignite your eaves and then your roof's on fire. So that's number two. Number three is screen all your vents. And this is a weekend project. I mean, all these things are weekend projects you can do with your kids.
What kind of screen do you use? Because I understand that those embers can get into the vent.
Right.
And that's a disaster. What kind of screening should you use? Like, because I'm looking at, our home is built in the 60s. And so the little screen mesh vents, they're really big. And I could see where embers could enter there. What do you cover that with?
Well, you just go to Home Depot and get 1/8 inch mesh. Now, it might be a little bit challenging depending on how your venting is. Our house had round vents down below, and then it had those little two flapper things that, the flappers never really stay shut, and I wouldn't trust them in a 60-mile-an-hour wind to stay shut.
Oh, yeah.
So I retrofitted, and I went down to the sheet metal company and got some covers made that I just put on in the dry, bone dry season, fire season, or when, I track the weather, and so I use watch duty, and I use windy, and I know when the situation warrants me, taping that stuff shut. But if you just retrofit it all with 1/8 mesh. You can go get a Vulcan vent, which I did on some of mine, which is this special, it's called intumescent mesh. When it gets heat, it seals up. It sort of melts a bit, not melts, but it changes shape and close seals it up. And there's Vulcan vents makes them for your eaves, for your dormers, depending on your roof assembly and your crawl space, or whether you have an unvented house. That's all out there. So check out Ember Defense Systems or Vulcan Vents are good sources of more advanced pieces. But, you can do it with just 1/8 inch mesh.
1/8 inch mesh. Okay, good. Okay, what's next on your list?
Well, one of the things that's, is trees. And trees aren't really that high on the list, because if you look at 4 decades of Jack Cohen's experiments and reports that he's written with his contemporary up there in Canada, for like all the gnarly fires up there and all the ones he's been on, which you see even with Paradise. You see burned down homes and green trees all around. Mm-hmm. You're like, what the what? Well, here's the thing. Most homes are ignited by embers. They're not ignited by radiant heat from trees on fire. And in the target conditions, a wind-driven fire that's casting embers, it's not a vertical fire. It's a horizontal fire. In other words, you know, it's just, it's like driven snow. So if you have overhanging branches, it might be a good idea to cut that down. And now if you have a juniper or a cypress anywhere near your structure, you want to get rid of the arborvitae because those things flash burn at like 800 degrees and can crack your windows at 30 feet out. So they're a particularly dangerous thing to have. Arborvitae has to go from communities like in it, and Home Depot and the rest of them shouldn't be selling it anymore. But otherwise, trees are, you know, maybe some limbing up, and you want to be careful with that because, you know, get a good arborist. But anyway, I'll just leave it at that. Like, the odds of a crown fire in a discontinuous canopy, right, a broken up canopy in a urban or suburban environment with roads and whatnot, that's just not the risk, right? It's not a wall of flames. Most homes are burning well after the flame front has passed. And so therefore, the other one you need to think about, the fifth one, is the connected fence. You know, people say fences make good neighbors, but fences make wicks to your house. And they also make incredible ember catchers in a wind-driven wildfire. And they often frequently ignite after the flame front is passed by smoldering stuff underneath them. So, you know, replace that last 5 feet of fence with like metal or wire mesh, or you can treat the wood, but then that's ephemeral. You know, you got to come back and do it. And some of those products maybe haven't really been tested in the, as Jack would say, the target conditions.
So that's the list of five. If yep. people can kind of take care of those, that's an excellent way to help to fire harden your property.
That's right. And, you know, there's other things they use in Australia, and I have, but they're challenging. And people, you know, a lot of people think fire, they think water, okay? The problem with that is everyone had a sprinkler system and connected to the municipal system, and then homes start to burn, and then what happens is that home burns and it breaks the pressure on the system, and we have footage from Palisades of, you know, bubbling fountains in the ruined wreck of a burned out home, and just giving you a visual of that. In other words, all those burned out homes collapse the water system and water pressure. And if everyone thinking they can, you know, mist or wet everything down. Now, if you know it's red flag conditions, and if you have time and you wet down, not soak, but wet down the perimeter of your property, possibly even wet down the roof, but you really don't need to do that unless you have a bunch of fine material on your roof, you know, in a valley of your roof, right, where two roof sections meet and it creates right. a little V. You know, there's people, I know tons of people lots of people I've met and have told me their stories about wetting down their house, evacuating, and it worked. But there are companies that sell them. There's definitely been a lot of saves in Palisades with some of these water systems. They're bringing the cost down on them. The challenge is, when is it triggered? How much water is it applying? Is it vulnerable to be, you know, does it need power to operate? You know, is it vulnerable to municipal things? But ultimately, Jack is not a huge fan of those because of all those things I just ticked off about how they're vulnerable. Because he's like, look, just assume there won't be defenders, assume the water system will fail, modify the conditions of your house so it won't ignite.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And of course, we've been hearing all of this stuff, and I don't know if you want to comment on it or not, about the fire hydrants, you know, going dry. And it seems to me that those fire hydrants are designed for individual fires in neighborhoods, not a massive conflagration where you're trying to just, you know, pull water out of all of them all at once. It doesn't seem like that's a real feasible thing to do.
That's definitely a great point, Dave. And I think I'll just add a little more context. I was talking to the chief of all chiefs, Dr. Lori Moore Merrill, who was down there with LA County Fire and Orange County Fire. And then I got footage from my team that's there. And then I talked to a fire investigator and others and Jack. I talked to Jack about this. There's a lot of inane, misleading disinformation, you know, everyone coming in Monday morning quarterbacking. It's frankly quite upsetting. It builds a lot of sort of a quiet rage within me on behalf of fire survivors that, You know, that kind of line of thinking is dangerous. You know, look, if LA County would have had more resources, all the resources they'd asked in budgets, they probably still would have had a fraction of a firefighter per home or structure in the fire's path. I remember Jesse, I think it was Jesse Alexander from Yuba City Fire. On Paradise, he said, we would have needed every firefighter from all of California in Paradise in less than an hour, gassed up with full amount of water, to have a chance of saving a third of the homes.
Yeah, it's not feasible.
And here's the thing. That's why we need to be a force multiplier by fire comes. There's the collapse of the water system as houses start to burn. The other thing is, in a wind-driven firestorm, a hose from a fire truck is applying 3,000 gallons a minute, way too much water in the wrong way, right? It's a directed stream to put out a structure. Aircraft were grounded, and as the top Firehawk helicopter pilot for LA County Fire, Mike Sagely, says in our film, it's like, what are you doing other than accepting a large level of risk? The water isn't even hitting the ground. So even a 3,000 gallon a minute hose stream is vaporizing in, as you put it in the beginning, desiccated downslope winds. In other words, it's just turning into mist. It's not hitting the target. So, I mean, from my perspective, that water system behaved incredibly well. And California and SoCal is some of the best water manipulators on the face of this earth. I mean, look at where they've taken water from and all the projects and, you know, all the films made about all the stuff and political intrigue around California's ability to move water and use water. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous to say that there wasn't enough water available. You know, what there needs to be is people need to understand that the fire services and the firefighters are part of our community, that our expectations for their ability to put wet stuff on the red stuff is unhelpful, unfair, and frankly puts way too much burden on them and is probably part of the reason why they're so darn stressed.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother issue is, you know, we're having a harder and harder time getting enough people to want to be firefighters, especially forest firefighters.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if we do the things, we're a force multiplier, right? You know, I mean, it's great to say we support firefighters when fire comes, but let's support firefighters before fire comes. We need to do everything we can to prevent the preventable ones.
The other interesting thing, and maybe we can kind of close on a more hopeful note, is when you go out in the natural landscape and you see where fire has burned and you go back after it's been through there, you know, a few months later, I'll use an example. I'll use Paradise as an example. I went up to Paradise after the campfire, I believe it was late December. And the fire, of course, was started on November 8th of 2018. And I saw the devastation to the homes and everything. But, you know, that's not what I loved about. What I loved about Paradise wasn't the homes. It was the place and the beauty of nature there. And I could see already the regeneration happening, that nature was already reclaiming these spaces. And I thought to myself, yeah, this is a human disaster, but nature's resiliency is on full display.
Yeah, totally, man. I mean, I love that stuff. I do a lot of time-lapse and wildlife photography, and it brings me great joy. And, you know, there's a lot of cool things in nature, like the ponderosa pine thick bark tree is a thing that we borrowed from to build the space shuttle tiles and the dissipation of heat. And then just like these birds that are like fire adapted and they gather, you know, 40,000 seeds a year. Like, that's just incredible, right? Or they make a cavity and then that makes a home for the mountain bluebird to come in. I'm certainly concerned to some extent about the intensity of fire, like the Park Fire and the conditions in which it's occurring, or places that are burning multiple times, or let's say timber plantations that are burning really super hot. But high severity fire is part of the landscape. Medium severity fire is part of the landscape. I specifically spend a lot of time in the high severity patches in Oregon and other places. And there's so much beauty to see there. And it is very heartening. And I think a lot of fire survivors that I've interacted with around both seeing elemental and they've seen some of the other time-lapse work it's that sense of place and knowing that that place is okay and wanting to care for that place. That is, like you say, as important as the home. It's part of our home. And so I think we can learn a lot of lessons from nature. And we also, you know, if we accept natural realities, we and do the things that Jack and others like him tell us, we can live with fire.
Well, Ralph Blomer is director of Fire Safe Communities based up in Portland, Oregon. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us and your experiences and, you know, putting some of this in perspective. Because as you said, when you see all this disinformation and the constant news cycling going on, you can tend to not see the forest through the trees.
You're welcome, Dave. Thank you for what you do and for bringing this to your community.
Thanks again to our guests, Stephen Pine and Ralph Blomers. I highly recommend Professor Pine's recent book, The Pyrocene: How We Created an Age of Fire and What Happens Next. It's available at most major booksellers or order it at your local bookstore. You can learn more about Ralph Blomers' work on wildfire and communities at greenoregon.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.